Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to New Books in Hindu Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran, and today I have the distinct pleasure of speaking with Dr. Gopal Gupta, who is Associate Professor at the University of Evansville, and he's also the editor of the Journal of Hindu Christian Studies. Gopal, welcome to the podcast.
Hello, Raj. It's a pleasure to be here today.
Yes, it's a pleasure to have you, particularly as we're speaking on your brand new book, called Maya and the Bhagavad Purana. Now, I've heard of the Puranas. I've heard of the Puranas. These are these interesting texts. But it's brand new. Do you want to tell us exactly how new it is?
Well, it was actually released just today by Oxford University Press. If you go to their website, you'll see December 22nd. So somehow the stars aligned and we're having this interview and podcast today. Thank you, Raj.
You know, I do what I can, but this one I didn't arrange because I had emailed Gopal a few months back, and sometimes, as you well know, authors will interview before the book comes out, and he opted to wait until the book came out, and then we couldn't find a suitable date for a number of reasons, and the stars have aligned, as they say, for us to speak about your fascinating publication on the day of its birth into the world. But before its birth, there was no doubt a gestation and the conception. So why don't you tell us about the process whereby this book was conceived and nurtured?
It's interesting you mentioned that metaphor, because when I was in grad school at Oxford University, many people told me that writing your dissertation and your first book is very much like having your first child. And I agree, the process of writing this book took 10 years, exactly 10 years. I started working on it intensively in 2010 as a graduate student at Oxford University. I graduated in 2014, and now in 2020, it's been actually released. People used to tell me that it takes 10 years to write a book. And I was like, really, 10 years? But yes, indeed, 10 years, the entire process of writing it and then finding a publisher and then, you know, revising it and re-revising it and then publishing it. So it all began with an interest, a deep interest that I had in understanding the nature of the world as it is conceived by these ancient texts. There's so many topics I could work on, but I wanted to understand, you know, how is the world understood? What is the nature of matter, the nature of nature in these ancient texts, and particularly the Sanskrit texts? And that led me to the Bhagavad Purana, and that led me to writing this book on Maya in the Bhagavad Purana.
So a 10-year gestation, that's a Mahabharata-esque pregnancy, but not atypical, I think, for most books. And the thing about the dissertation that's apt, that no one tells you going in, is the labor pains. You will experience labor to pop that thing out one way or another. Why the Bhagavata Purana? This is a text that has held interest for you. And maybe tell us a bit about looking at narrative text through the lens of this philosophical concept?
Well, why the Bhagavad Purana? To answer that question, I particularly actually studied this text because it really should not be, it should not be a surprise to scholars and students of Hinduism why we should study the Bhagavad Purana. Because if we actually look at the living religions of India, we find that the Bhagavata ranks along with the Mahabharata and the Ramayana in terms of the influence that it's had. It's inspired architecture, ritual recitations, dance, drama, more recently film. Edwin Bryant, in his translation of the 10th book of the Bhagavad Purana, he says that second to the Ramayana, the Bhagavad Purana has probably, no other text has had more influence than the Bhagavad Purana on all aspects of Hindu culture. Like I mentioned, dance, drama, music, architecture. It's a work of over 14,000 Sanskrit verses. Most Puranas just have one or two commentaries, if that. Most Puranas don't have any commentaries, and some of the famous ones have one or two. But the Bhagavad Purana alone has 81 commentaries. And these are the extant commentaries that we have. There's so many more that are probably lost to antiquity. So many commentaries. A book that has 81 commentaries has obviously had a powerful influence in the culture and philosophical field of Hindu thought.
So certainly the Bhagavata is extraordinarily popular among Puranas, without question. I think my last work was looking a little bit at the Markandeya Purana, which, there's much to be written on the Markandeya Purana yet.
Yes.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about the structure of the book, the way you've ordered the chapters?
So maybe just as a slight lead up to that point, why Maya in the Bhagavad Purana? The reason why I focused on the Bhagavad Purana in the context of Maya is that when I actually came to study this concept of Maya, I looked at it starting the Vedas and into the Upanishads, the Vedanta Sutra, and then the Puranas, and the epics and the Mahabharata. I found that unlike the common perception of the concept of Maya, Maya is really not that central. It is clearly not a central concept in the Upanishads. The commentators make it into a central idea. But in all the Upanishadic literature, it appears like 14 times, just 14 instances of it. And even that primarily in the later Upanishads, like the Shvetashvara Upanishad. We find an explosion of the term of Maya in the Puranas. The first time in the history of Indian texts where we really find this term explodes as a concept and is developed. It's not in the epics, it's not in the Upanishads, in the Vedas to some degree, but as a philosophical concept, it explodes in the Puranas, and particularly the Bhagavata. So the first chapter of my book, this is what I do. I look at the history of the development of the term Maya throughout all of these various texts, and starting from the Vedas, the epics, the Upanishads, the Vedanta Sutra, and in this way, look at the development of this term, Maya. Then in the second chapter, I look at Maya as a whole in the Bhagavad Purana itself. How is that term in general? What are the ways in which it's used? And that's another key point, is that there's not one use or one usage of the term Maya in the Bhagavad Purana. And then I focus on the first usage of Maya in the Bhagavata, and that is as the world. So Maya as the world, which is a very central, very crucial topic for not just philosophy, but also sociology, political science, psychology. Because if the world is Maya, and we interpret Maya to be illusion, then is the world an illusion? So I really thought that this was an important, topic to discuss. What is the nature of the world and Maya in the Bhagavad Purana? Then I looked at Maya in the context of the human condition. So it's illusive and delusive effects, you know, possibly the most famous usage of Maya that you find in general, Maya as this sort of negative, illusive, dreamlike state. Then in the next chapter, I look at something that's very unique to the Bhagavad Purana and an aspect of Maya that has not been studied, and that is Maya's positive role, the powerful role that it has in the Bhagavata as an agency or power for spiritual experience, for yoga, for union. And then I look at Maya in the context of women. So the, you know, trope that Maya is our women, and, you know, women are Maya. And then I look at Maya in terms, in the context of the problem of evil, problem of suffering. So in the Bhagavata, if this is creative energy, if this is the power of God, why is this energy so elusive and cause of such suffering? And finally, I look at narratives in the Bhagavad Purana on freedom from Maya. So if Maya is this chain that binds us to this world, how do we get free? How do we break the bonds of Maya? And how does the Bhagavata see moksha or liberation from the world of Maya? So this is the basic breakdown, you know, 8 chapters, that's the conclusion.
Yeah, it's a fascinating read. I'm slightly biased towards narrative and philosophical concepts, nevertheless, there's much there. I had sort of a note in the back of my brain to write an article called Maya and then in the Devi Mahatmya at some point. Would you say then, could you tell us a bit about the extent to which Maya in the Bhagavata Purana is not necessarily this pejorative, negative, illusory, entrapping entity that needs to be overcome, but can you touched on it just now, but can you tell us a bit more about the positive or beneficial, useful elements or aspects of Maya in the Bhagavata Purana?
Well, you know, this is Vedanta philosophy, as you mentioned, has generally seen Maya as something that is to be avoided, something to be transcended, and something that is very elusive. And this is the very point that you brought up. You touched at the heart of the book that I found very surprising when I started reading the Bhagavata, that it really isn't like that, because, and the reason is actually grounded in the philosophical history of Indian thought, because Vedanta has now become the most dominant philosophical discourse in India and abroad and in academics. But historically speaking, from the time of the Bhagavad Purana, Vedanta may not have been that popular as it is today. And in fact, many notable scholars have pointed out that the dominant philosophical system in the history of Sanskrit texts, the most common one that you find is Sankhya. You find Sankhya all the way back to the Upanishads. You find it in the Mahabharata, all over the place, in the epics. You find it in the Puranas. You find it in the Bhagavad Gita. The Sankhya philosophy was like the bread and butter philosophy of these texts. And how does Sankhya see this world? How does it see Prakriti? Sankhya sees Prakriti as mother. It does have a negative, you could say, a role to some degree. Like all mothers chastise their naughty kids, and we are certainly the children of Prakriti in these Puranic narratives. But overall, a mother is a loving, kind entity with good intentions for the children. So if the Bhagavata is drawing from the Sankhya philosophical discourse, then it sees Prakriti as a divine mother. And on so many occasions in the Bhagavata, throughout the Bhagavata, you see this. There are prayers to Prakriti in the Bhagavad Purana. You know, devotees praying, glorifying Maya and Prakriti. And now, what makes the Bhagavata such a marvelous text is that the Bhagavata is one text that brings together many different philosophical strains and systems of thought into one book. So it tries to synthesize Vedanta and Sankhya. And many scholars have noted this. Basically all scholars in recent times that I've read have noted how the Bhagavata is a book that synthesizes many different philosophical systems. You find Vaisheshika philosophy in their Sankhya and Vedanta, Mimamsa, but particularly it synthesizes Vedanta and Sankhya. So when it brought Vedanta and Sankhya together, it identified the concepts of Maya and Prakriti. It equated them. It said Prakriti is Maya and Maya is Prakriti. And therefore, since Prakriti is Divine Mother, Maya, being the energy of God, is also a Divine Mother. And to be very explicit, the Bhagavata gives it a particular role. It personifies it, and it says that Maya is Yoga Maya, which is the younger sister of Krishna. And being a Vaishnava text and being a Krishna-based text, Krishna is, Krishna is God in the Bhagavata Purana. And his sister is his energy, Yoga Maya, that takes the form of Yoga Maya and is taking the role of mother, is trying to, through this process of karma and the sufferings of this world, dukkha, is trying to rectify the jivas of the world. So it has a very distinct worldview that cannot be ignored. There are certainly exceptions to that worldview. There are certainly, you could say, different narratives in the Bhagavata that complicate this issue. But overall, Maya is seen as a positive force. And one of Maya's roles is to be provide a school of hard knocks. But the overall intention of Maya is one of Prakriti, which is one of a compassionate mother.
So Maya takes on a pedagogical or instructive hue rather than an inclusive hue for its own sake. What so fascinates me is that the Devi Mahatmya is in my view, an important text for a number of reasons, not least of which is the first time we see in sort of Sanskrit Hindudom, we see a conscious crafting of this theological vision of the divine that's feminine, where Maya equals Prakriti equals Shakti, which is beyond even the Purusha of Sankhya, right? You have this vision, this re-rendering of Maya as, this is the garb of the Devi, mm-hmm. right? Who deludes and liberates alike. And so I see it's easy, and perhaps it's my own bias, so please correct mm-hmm. me if you think I'm off, but I sort of see the Bhagavata Purana as leveraging that, or at least a flowering of that crystallization we see in the Devi Mahatmya.
Yes, and I would in fact argue perhaps the other way around, that the Devi Bhagavata and the Devi Mahatmya are taking narratives that you find in the Vaishnava Puranas, one of them being the Bhagavata, and you could say transforming them in the discourse of Devi. So I noted this in my book and in many places, that how the Devi Bhagavata, it takes certain narratives of the Bhagavata, like for example the narrative of the Markandeya Purana, and perhaps not directly from the Bhagavata, but you find earlier versions of this narrative, and it takes the narrative of Markandeya and it transforms it. It changes the narrative, where now Markandeya and Krishna are no longer just the two players in that narrative, but the final, the final conclusion of that narrative is that Markandeya sees Krishna in the arms of Devi, and she's cradling Krishna in her arms, and therefore Maya is the source of Vishnu or Krishna. So because she's the mother, the divine mother, and she gives birth in some ways to Krishna and Vishnu. In earlier versions of the narrative, you don't find this. These narratives have their different versions, and so you don't find it like that, presented in that way in the Bhagavata. You find it the other way around. You consistently, the Bhagavata says that how Yoga Maya or Maya is the Shakti of Bhagavan, and that Bhagavan is Vishnu or Krishna. So, and this is how the traditions, you could say, negotiate the role of Shakti. Naturally, the Shakta traditions see Shakti as a source of Vishnu and Krishna, and the Vaishnava and even Shaiva traditions, they see Shakti as the power of Vishnu or Shiva. So who comes first? That's a matter of, you know, debate.
And for those of you listening who aren't scholars of Hinduism, dating is extraordinarily problematic. And I want to preface that before I ask the next question. When approximately would you date the Bhagavad Purana?
Academics today date it anywhere from 4th century CE to 4th century BCE. So it's the common academic conclusion is that it's a text that develops over time. There's no one specific date when it, you know, when the Bhagavata takes birth. But there are, you know, references of it, there are inscriptions of it dating back to the 4th century CE, which means that in some form or the other, maybe not in the full 14,000 verses, the Bhagavata existed starting 4th century CE. And, you know, various scholars have worked on this far more in depth than I have. That was not so much my concern in my own work. The dating of the text was not my major concern, but, you know, it's reasonable to say that it started in a smaller form and, you know, developed over time. Of course, tradition would say that it's, you know, 5,000 years old. That's the traditional viewpoint. So you have the traditional dating and you have the academic.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
It's fascinating. And of course, you have a kindred spirit in one who prefers the world within the text over the world behind it, because the one we have clear purview of for the most part, and the other is so opaque. And so courageous and or foolish are they who attempt to date texts of Indian origin, or some combination. But no, it's narrative, right? Like the this is a work where you're looking at the narrative, and you're analyzing plot, characterization, right? My favorite metaphor is that, you know, when you're thirsty, you want something liquid and you don't want a coconut. But a coconut, once cracked, it's the most hydrating, delicious sort
of liquid.
And so this impulse to crack the coconut of narrative and see, you know, see what emerges. Is that, are you comfortable with narrative? Will you be continuing to study narrative? Can you tell us a bit about that process?
Like you, I think that was the most enjoyable part for me in working on this book. I love working with narratives. I especially, when coming to ancient Sanskrit texts, working with civilizations, with cultures that, you know, that we, during the present time, don't have direct access to. I love working with narratives, because how much can you unpack from short phrases, short philosophical, you know, discussions. The spirit of what they felt, the spirit of what they believed in, the spirit of their philosophical thought is revealed in the narratives. Otherwise, there are so many, you know, sections in the Bhagavata that that are from different strains of philosophical thought, as I mentioned. And one could not make any conclusion as to what the Bhagavata itself, you know, wants to communicate simply by analyzing specific verses, because one will find different verses saying different things. But when we look at the text as a whole, when we look at the narratives, we find that no, there is a, you could say, a genre of literature here. There is a feeling that is expressed through these narratives that is undeniably, you know, clear, in that they did have certain ideas that they were very much in tune with exceptions. But you can draw conclusions. You can draw you can develop on that discussion if you look at the narratives, rather than just the philosophical discussions.
And there's such that familiarity is required. Upon spending time with the narrative and becoming familiar, just like with a person, you internalize so much quote unquote data about the person. And when you spend time, especially daily for some time in the world of a text, there is a zeitgeist, there is an ethos, there is an imaginaire. And then it's up to the conscious mind to latch on to what can be demonstrated and articulated. But the first step for me is to become acquainted with the text. Else, the conscious mind could easily justify something, and this happens in my view all too often, at least historically in the study of Sanskrit narrative. The conscious mind can justify something that may sound cogent as an argument, but go against the entire fabric of the text. At least as it seems to me.
Yes, indeed. And that was part of the, you could say, the what took the bulk of the time in writing this book is carefully studying all the narratives in the Bhagavata, and then not just studying them in the Bhagavata, but also looking at earlier versions of those narratives and how that narrative, why is it significant? Why is it present in the Bhagavata? And what is that narrative used in the service of in the text? So for example, I can you know, point at the Rasa Leela narrative in the Bhagavad Gita. The Rasa Leela is one of the most famous parts of the Bhagavata. And when studying that narrative very carefully, what is not apparent in the first reading is that the Rasa Leela is situated in the framework of yoga. So the successive stages of the gopis' devotion towards Krishna, their states of meditation, their emotions, actually follow the eightfold yoga practice as we find in the Yoga Sutras. The language is also enmeshed in the language of the Yoga Sutras, and yoga in general, maybe not specifically the Yoga Sutras, but even, you know, the yoga that you find in other texts. And so much of it is enmeshed in the practice of yoga. So one can see that there is, you know, there is a connection here between the Rasa Leela, Bhakti, and yoga in the Bhagavata Purana, where the Bhagavata is trying to show, is trying to, you know, being part of a bhakti movement and being a bhakti text, the Bhagavata is trying to situate itself in discourses of yoga and show that bhakti can be a form of yoga. Another example is how the Bhagavata starts as a reflection on the Mahabharata. And, you know, it starts with the narrative of Draupadi and Ashwatthama and the five Pandavas, and it's reflecting on the horrors of the Mahabharata battle. And therefore, so much of the Bhagavata draws from the Mahabharata. And at the very end, in the 11th book, you have the Uddhava Gita, which is a transformation, you know, just a different rendition of the Bhagavad Gita. So the Bhagavata is conscientiously at so many points aligning itself with the Mahabharata and reflecting on the Mahabharata and, you know, continuing with that tradition.
So interesting, the Markandeya Purana also starts off with Jaimini, a student of Vyasa. going to Markandeya Mahamuni himself and saying, you know, I've studied the Mahabharata and I just can't make sense of these four questions. Can you help me answer these four questions? And one, of course, is about the polyandry of Draupadi, but so you can see the stitching. It's so clear that the Puranas are a continuation and an embellishment of the epic tradition, folding in. These are the tissues of what we call Hinduism, right? These are ecosystems, right? There's so much in there. And that's why it's hazardous to try and study the Puranas. And I have a little bit of sympathy for earlier generations of colonial scholars who dismissed them as like haphazard patchwork nonsense. Clearly, they're much more than that, but I can almost sympathize with the impulse that they're unwieldy, but they're doing so much. Just as Hinduism is not a thing, it's an ecosystem, so too the Puranas. They are the reflection of what we call Hinduism. They're folding in all the strands of the Hindu tapestry, and that's why they're the most current.
Absolutely, Raj. I think you've put it in such nice words, so beautifully, that the Puranas are a reflection of the very feeling and fabric of Hinduism. And it was very difficult, actually, to study the Bhagavata. It took me years to just read it and reread it. And just because the content is so diverse, it is bringing in so many things. However, the reason why it's so rewarding is that it is reflecting the way that people, even to this day, Hindu practitioners think of their faith. You know, it's all, when you talk to practitioners today, you know, it all combines somehow, and it's all one, but it's still different. And the Puranas reflect that, you could say that they're very comfortable. What I find so amazing is that they're so comfortable with the diversity, and they don't find the need to try to resolve it. At the same time, there are specific messages and motivations that the writers have that they want to communicate. Like, for example, the Bhagavata also is very much it speaks in favor of the lower castes and, relatively speaking to other texts, in favor of women and most of the heroes of the Bhagavata, the greatest saints and sages of the Bhagavata are not the typical orthodox Brahmanas, but they are people like Narada who are born in Shudra or outcast families, maidservants. Those become the greatest sages of the Bhagavata, and they give their stories. So you see that it is a reflection also on Hindu culture and Hindu society. And there is an effort to advance, you could say, the project, the plan of bhakti in favor of jnana and other more orthodox practices and systems to make it more inclusive to all castes and people of that civilization.
Well, this is the real power of narrative, you know, this penchant for polyphony, for paradox, right? This is where you reflect the messiness of life. You know, you can't have a sutra of this is how you live, and this is what it is, and this is what the divine is, and this is what your dharma is. So narrative, it folds in these different voices somewhat antithetically at times, but nevertheless, there's a penchant for ideology, for a message, for a theme. It's on the one hand, trying to school you when you least expect it and advance a platform or polemic or theme. And on the other hand, it's going to try to fold in various voices. And as I say, I'm slightly biased. I do love all of my interviewees and all of their books without question. But clearly, It happens that both your methodology to a large extent and your object of study happens to be similar to my own. So forgive the outpourings. No.
I'm so happy and excited about this, because Certainly there's things then we can work on together.
That is possible, like Maya in the Devi Mahatmya. So your subtitle, Human Suffering in the Divine Play, what does your research show about human suffering, or at least indic observations thereof?
I particularly was very interested in this topic because, you know, it's a really practical question. It's a question that is not just in philosophical discourse, but it's also something that practitioners of every religious tradition reflect upon. And so, you know, it shows the relevance of the study of Maya. Well, the study of Maya sheds some light on the problem of suffering, or more commonly known as a problem of evil. And this is why the study of Maya is relevant to contemporary discourse, even outside of Indian traditions. So what does Maya say about human suffering? What does the Bhagavata say about human suffering? I feel it's something very notable because discussions on human suffering in Indian religions have largely revolved around the idea of karma. Okay, if you're going to talk about human suffering in Hinduism, you have to talk about karma, and that's where it starts and that's where it ends. But here in Bhagavata, we find a discourse that goes beyond karma, that realizes, that sort of addresses the limitations of karma and says that the problem is larger, the problem is bigger. And the response to suffering has to be deeper. So what is that? Well, there's a conversation between Bhishma and Yudhishthira after the Kurukshetra battle that takes place in the Mahabharata, and then you find it continued in the Bhagavata, on the problem of suffering. In this discussion, Yudhishthira has come to Bhishma and has expressed that he feels horrible about this battle. He feels devastated that so many people died as a result of this battle and as a result of trying to put him on the throne. And furthermore, what complicates the issue for both Bhishma and Yudhishthira is that all the while, all of this has happened, and Yudhishthira is like righteousness personified. From the very beginning, he has good intentions. He doesn't want to fight. He's tried every method he can on the planet to try to make his cousin brother, Duryodhana, like him, and, you know, establish a friendship with him. So he's clearly not looking for violence. He's clearly not a violent or evil person. He's one of the kindest people alive on the planet, yet he keeps being pushed into situations of conflict and violence that he does not like. And why is this the case? So Bhishma reflects on this question. And he says, the first thing that he says, that, well, in your case, Yudhishthira, the answer cannot be karma. In your case, you could not be suffering due to your past karma, because I'm sorry, you're just too good. And this is the, you could say, the Bhagavata version of the problem of Job that you find, you know, in the Bible. And he says, no, karma is not a response. So he says, well, let's look at other causes or possible causes for the problem of evil, for the cause of your suffering. And then he switches to time. He says, perhaps kala, or time, just the very nature of this world is the cause of your suffering. And then he says, well, no, that also can be the cause, because you know, you have been very devoted and you are a spiritually, you know, evolved person, and time does not affect the sages. And then he goes on to daiva, to destiny. Is perhaps it's destiny. It's just destiny due to why you are suffering in this world. But then what is destiny? And that's a huge topic. And the commentators on those texts really unpack this, and they say, well, destiny is still not satisfying because destiny either refers to your past karma or it refers to the will of God. And being a, you know, a monotheistic text, the Bhagavata does believe in a God and the will of God. And so clearly destiny just isn't a force in of itself. And so then finally Bhishma says that, I think the only cause for your suffering could be the plan of God. That there is some unknown plan that is behind all of this, and it's going to unfold. It has unfolded and it's going to unfold. And there is a good purpose. There's a divine purpose behind it, this. So he actually mentions, you know, in this discussion how this plan is unknowable, although he feels that the plan of God is always perfect. Providing, you could say, a very interesting, very different outlook to suffering that goes deeper and says, well, karma is not in play in all forms of suffering in this world. There might be other forces, other purposes involved in the suffering, especially of righteous people.
What a brilliant response. And I'm glad that you brought in some of the narrative, because one of my questions next was going to be, you know, share some of the narratives, or perhaps I can ask this question. What parts of the book did you most enjoy writing, and or passages that you most enjoy interpreting?
I particularly enjoyed writing, which is, which one? Just looking up here. We got the chapter number. It's Maya's... in the absolute realm, Maya's role in the absolute realm, that's chapter 5. Maya as Yoga Maya. I particularly enjoyed writing that chapter just because in this context, Maya is closely connected to the discussion of Leela in the Bhagavad Purana. And Leela, as you know, it's a concept that is very unique to Hinduism. A god that plays, a god that, you know, acts just for the sake of pleasure and playing, is something you don't find in, you know, discussed much in the worlds, in the religions of the world. So Leela is a concept that is, you know, needs a lot of unpacking. And one of the aspects of Leela is the thing that makes Leela effective or powerful is that the participants in Leela forget who they actually are. And they lose themselves in the drama. Leela is really the best drama, so much so that the actors become completely absorbed in the roles that they play. And that's what makes Leela possible. And not only do the devotees of Krishna forget their real identities, but the Bhagavata says that Krishna himself, in the flow of Leela, forgets that he is God. So he actually, you know, loses his remembrance, his recognition of his divine position. And in order for that to happen, something has to make it happen. And that is the specific role of Maya or Yoga Maya, where Maya is something in the positive context that not only, you could say, influences the devotees, but it also influences God. So it describes that Krishna, Upashita, these are the words that are mentioned there. He takes recourse or resorts or takes shelter of Maya in the context of his Leela. So here we have a concept where God is so powerful that God is powerful enough to disempower himself. God is powerful enough to forget himself by the power of his own Maya. And I think that's something that's just very cool, very neat.
That's definitely cool, without question. I had meant to mention it earlier, but perhaps now is a more opportune moment. So in the Devi Mahatmya, there are four stutis, four hymns to the goddess that are placed in the mouth of various gods. There's a pattern, a hymn of invocation, one of thanksgiving, one of invocation, one of thanksgiving. So the second hymn of invocation, I believe it's called the Iparajita Stuti. It is the most famous Yadevi hymn to the goddess, Yadevi Sarvabhuteshu, to that goddess who resides in all beings in the form of X, Y, Z, P, Q, and there are a number of attributes of Mahadevi. The first one is Yadevi Sarvabhuteshu Vishnu Mayeti Shabdida Namastasyei 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 Namo Namaha Vishnu Maya, like the first one.
Yes.
Of all the attributes, perhaps the one that enables her to live in all beings as thirst, as hunger, as modesty, as intelligence, as confusion, is the fact that in this text, she is Vishnu Maya. She is the Maya Vishnu. And in this text, it's easy to see why Vishnu Maya would have its own agency, because of course, it's part of the Shakti that is the supreme, the Mahadevi. But it was reminiscent. What you're saying is reminiscent of that, of the way in which that term has worked, that concept has worked in the Devi Mahatmya.
Yes, absolutely. And it's Maya definitely in the Bhagavata also has agency. She's personified as Yogamaya, as Subhadra, as in so many different roles and forms. There's this interplay. There's the discussion of Shakti and Shaktiman, how the power is non-different than the powerful, yet it is also different. And the philosophical viewpoint of the Bhagavata is one of bheda bheda, of oneness and difference. So Shakti is one with Bhagavan, yet she is also different. And Shakti is different, yet also one. And so the Bhagavata is not a dualist text, nor is it a monistic text. Adheres to this idea of oneness and difference. So the Shakti is one with God, yet also different. But, on many occasions it emphasizes the fact how this Shakti is employed by Bhagavan for his Leela. And the moment that he wants to remember his power, like for example, in Krishna Leela, when in the middle of the Rasa Leela or in the middle of various Leelas, he has to fight with some asuras who come and attack him, then Krishna immediately remembers who he is and comes out of that state of forgetfulness. And so in that case, it is not Maya who's still overpowering him, but then Maya is something that Krishna employs for the purpose of his own. And in that way, it's an energy that's very close to him and is utilized by him, but is fully under his control.
Fascinating. Is there anything else about the book you hoped we would touch on?
Personally, I think one of the contributions of this book is, in addition to its study of Maya, is its study of the Bhagavata itself. And the philosophical discussion that is revealed, the discourse on the nature of the self, God, nature of the self, God, and the world that is revealed through the discussions. And there's been a common perception of the Bhagavata, that the Bhagavata is either a text that does not have any clear philosophical viewpoint, or it's a text that's grounded in non-dualism, in Advaita, in the thought of monism and Advaita. And through this study, I show that how the Bhagavata negotiating all these different ideas, all these different concepts, yet it also does have a very clear philosophical thought. And particularly, for example, in the narrative of Uddhava, where that's been quoted very often, how at the end Uddhava goes to the gopis and gives them knowledge of Brahman and tells them, that the ultimate reality is Brahman, and it's, the ultimate goal is realizing Brahman. After that, much of the scholarship has noted that, but in the narrative itself, after that, Uddhava is the one who becomes influenced and overtaken by the gopis of Vrindavan. And Uddhava then desires to, or becomes a follower of the gopis, and realizes that his teaching of Brahman has had very little effect on the gopis. His teaching of Advaitic thought of Brahman and its nature has had very little effect on the gopis, and how their devotion, their bhakti for Krishna is overpowers their philosophical reasoning. So the Bhagavata is presenting, you could say, a very theistic, a very devotional viewpoint that I think has been missed in scholarship. It has not been you know, highlighted enough in scholarship. And a fair reading of the text itself, if we allow the text to speak for itself, rather than through later schools of thought, reveals the distinctive contribution to theism and to the devotional traditions and texts of India that the Bhagavata has made and that perhaps has not been studied in academia.
Fantastic and fascinating. And this, we're back to this important point, this methodological point of prioritizing and becoming familiar with the world within a text. And obviously it exists in a context. Obviously we are not operating in a vacuum. Mm-hmm. Obviously we have our own biases and predilections, but nevertheless, there is a world within the text with which one can become acquainted if one is able to exert the time and attention, right? Spend the time and attention. So it's been a pleasure speaking with you. I'll sign off. You'll stay on for a moment, if you will. We've been speaking today with Dr. Gopal Gupta on a brand new OUP publication, Birthed into the World Today on the 22nd of December, 2020. A publication called Maya in the Bhagavata Purana, Human Suffering and Divine Play. Thank you for being on the podcast.
Thank you, Raj. I really enjoyed our conversation and my time with you. I greatly appreciate it. Thank you for featuring my book.
As did I. Enjoyed it very much. Until next time, for those of you out there, stay safe, stay sane. Keep reading, keep listening, and keep contemplating the power of Maya.